Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 12, entitled Creation of the Kumaras and Others, text number 33. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Translation: the father of all Prajapatis, Brahma, thus seeing all his Prajapati sons speaking in that way, became very much ashamed and at once gave up the body he had accepted. Later, that body appeared in all directions as the dangerous fog in darkness. Responsibly, the father of all Prajapatis, Brahma, thus seeing all his Prajapati's sons speaking in that way, became very much ashamed, and at once gave up the body he had accepted. Later, that body appeared in all directions. As the dangerous fog in darkness. The best way to compensate for one's sinful acts is to give up one's body at once. And Brahma, the leader of the living entities, showed this by his personal example. Brahma has a fabulous duration of life, but he was obliged to give up his body due to his grievous sins, even though he had merely contemplated in his mind without having actually done it. This is a lesson for the living entities, showing how sinful an act it is to indulge in unrestricted sex life. Even to think of a bondful sex life as sinful, and to compensate for such sinful acts, one has to give up his body. In other words, one's duration of life, blessings, offerings, etc. are decreased by sinful acts. And the most dangerous type of sinful act is unrestricted sex. Ignorance is the cause of sinful life, or sinful life is the cause of gross ignorance. The feature of ignorance and darkness of the feature of ignorance is darkness or fog. Darkness or fog still covers the whole universe, and the sun is the only counteracting principle. One who takes shelter of the Lord, the perpetual light, has no fear of being annihilated in the darkness of fog or ignorance. Om Ajnana Timurinda Sat and International Adhar Chakshu Muritam Nena Tasmai Shri Guru Nirvimha Shri Chaitanya Nirvistam Svapitam Nena Bhutaya Swayam Prakaramaya Tadaja Svavarantikam Mukham Karoti Vashalam Pangam Langatri Girin Yantvatam Ham Pandeshi Muritam Some of you might have thought Naveen Anurag Prabhu was giving class. He's not here yet. So I just jumped in. So please bear with me in my spontaneity. So we're continuing with the pastime that just happened between the sons of Brahma and their father, their spiritual master, Lord Brahma, in which we have just heard the past few days how Lord Brahma was thinking of his daughter Vak, her speech, in a very lustful way within his mind. And of course his sons checked the behavior, but in a very, very respectful way. And Srila Prabhupada explains that the sages headed by Maharishi, the sages being the sons of Lord Brahma, weren't wrong in submitting their protest against the act of their father. They knew, of course, that this had been such a great act that had been like a big mistake, unusual mistake to have been performed by a person with the stature of Lord Brahma. So the sons thought that there must be some great purpose behind this whole pastime, this show, as Prabhupada puts it. So Srila Prabhupada mentions that it might be that Lord Brahma actually wanted to warn the human species, or wanted to warn the living entities of the frailties of dealing with the fair sex. So in this way, Lord Brahma is being used as an example, and this is why this certain section was explained the way that it had been. And in previous purpose, Srila Prabhupada is explaining that great personalities like Lord Brahma, even when in the wrong, they shouldn't be neglected, nor should great sages like Maharishi be shown any disrespect because of his extraordinary behavior. So the subordinates, of course, and their spiritual master had a particular type of relationship, and the petition or the protest by Maharishi and the other sons of Lord Brahma was done in a very, very respectful way. And they obviously knew there had to be a higher cause, a higher reason that this whole scenario had occurred, to instruct those to come in the future. So this is what led us to this text here today. So we're hearing so much about Lord Brahma's behavior, or the behavior of one in a elevated position, or one in a very, very respectful position, that their actions are always followed by their subordinates, or they act as a guide to those who look up to them. So it's very, very important that the behavior befit the post or the qualification given to that personality. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also mentions this about showing example in the famous verse, Yadyad Acharati Shrestat, Tad Tad Evitalagyana, Sad Brahman Kurute, Lugustad Anubhartate. In the chapter titled Karma Yoga, Krishna is explaining that whatever actions a great man performs, common and fellow, and whatever standards he sets by his example, the whole world will pursue. And that is something that we can see in this so-called modern world that we're living in, that great persons, people are deemed great, of course, due to the amount of wealth they might have, whether it's a birth in a high family, or they have great wealth or strength or beauty, etc. They are put in very much high esteem, so their actions act as a the actions, their personal lives, and how they conduct themselves is looked up by the common man, by the masses of people. So if you look at the politicians or presidents or movie stars, musicians, etc., everyone wants to behave like them. And when I say everyone, I'm just generalizing. Most persons want to be as glamorous as they are. Of course, not understanding that they are not behaving in a civilized manner, they're not behaving in the proper way. Lord Chaitanya explains in the purport to 321, Srila Prabhupada is explaining the standard taught by Lord Chaitanya, that a teacher should always behave properly before he begins teaching. So that is an ideal acharya, that is an ideal teacher, one who leads by his own personal example. So there's many persons who are deemed or seen as teachers, not only people who teach particularly in a school, but if you have any position in society, whether you're a policeman, you're a nurse, you're a lawyer, you're a tax collector, or you're a CEO of an organization, etc., people will always look up to you as a person of ideal character with ideal traits. So whatever they see, they will justify whatever they see or however they behave, they will justify it based on how they've seen your interactions. So if persons see their boss or their leaders indulging in sinful activities, they will think, well, if our leader can do it, he's fine, he's very much respected, he's eulogized, he is given so much profit and adoration, therefore I will also do it and I will also get some profit, name and adoration, etc. Therefore, persons continue in that web of deceit of thinking, my so-called leaders of today, although they might be engaging in unrestricted sinful activities, gaining so much respect, name, fame and adoration, and it is this which I'm also chasing for, this mirage in the material world of thinking, these material so-called traits will give one satisfaction. So we chase these things with the pursuit of happiness, and of course the opposite is reality. So we are not really happy when we get all these things. So Lord Chaitanya's teachings explained to us a man of, or a woman of ideal character, one who follows the codes that have been given in Shastra. So Srila Prabhupada mentions that a teacher cannot manufacture rules against the scriptures, sorry, against the principles of revealed scriptures. So nowadays everyone has their own sutras. Everyone has their own conclusions of what life is about. And it's based on their own mental speculation. It is based on their feelings and their emotions. I feel that life should be like this as this gender or that sex or that occupation or that social role. So all these absolute truths in the material sense are very, very temporary and very, very limiting, and they perpetuate one's existence, one's material consciousness. So the more one follows that which has not been stated in Shastra, which has not been stated in anything that's bona fide coming down from a parampara or a disciplic succession, one gets bound in a network of repeated suffering. So constant hankering and lamentation, which means you become covered more and more in the modes of passion and ignorance. Goodness, of course, not so much, but we become covered by the lowest modes of material nature. And this is just because persons are not following, or they're not living according to the revealed scriptures or texts, but they are living according to their manufactured understanding of what standard human civilization is. So being a leader or an executive head, or being a teacher, or if we're in a position of showing by our own personal example, this is a great responsibility to those that are subservient to you. And therefore, persons who take up those roles have to be conversant with the revealed texts or standard books of moral and spiritual codes. Otherwise, it will just be like the blind leading the blind, following a leader who is acting out of ignorance and passion. So that is not really such a intelligent thing to do. So the conversation that Marichi and his brothers were having with their father, Lord Brahma, was particularly to show example that if you behave in this way, or dear father, spiritual master, so many persons will follow your activity, and they will think that it is okay because you are the leader, you are the progenitor, you are the most intelligent being in the universe. You are the secondary creator. If you behave a certain way, those who are below you will think that this behavior is okay. So the sons of Lord Brahma, being having some spiritual knowledge, some understanding of action and inaction, we're speaking to Lord Brahma like this. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains how the best way to compensate for one's sinful act is to give up one's body at once. Now, of course, this is not the literal term that we all just go out the door and just go hang ourselves or just go commit some type of suicide, because we have, well, at least for myself, committed some sinful act in this lifetime. I can only speak for myself. So if we take this verbatim, then it's a misunderstanding. But as Prabhupada is explaining that in the previous text, actually, that Lord Brahma gave up the subtle attraction to his wife. So he didn't give up per se his body, but he gave up the mentality or the contaminative consciousness of trying to enjoy his daughter. So this is what Srila Prabhupada is talking about, and he was also explains that Lord Brahma's atonement, so to speak, was seen through his action of just giving up one's body at once. And he, of course, as we mentioned, what an acharya or a teacher is, he's showing by example that when one has been attacked by this sinful activity or this lust propensity, one has to get rid of that consciousness immediately. So Lord Brahma is showing by example, his own personal example, how to deal with the attack, the onslaught of the lust or anger or greed or envy, that we have to gradually but surely vanquish this enemy that we have within us, this lustful propensity. So although Lord Brahma himself, as Prabhupada mentions, has a fabulous duration of life, he was obliged to give up his body due to his previous sin, even though he had merely contemplated it in his mind without actually having done it. So even more interesting is that Lord Brahma was just contemplating the sinful action and it didn't manifest. Whereas sometimes in the material world we see, not only do we contemplate, not only do we have the sinful proclivity, not only do we have the seed, the sinful seeds planted within us, but we plan and we conspire and we manipulate and we carry out those sinful actions. So for us it's a very, very complicated matter, because we might not be that spiritually strong or intelligent. Whereas Lord Brahma, he is showing by example that immediately, just at the thinking, on the mental part, he cut out this this contaminating factor within his consciousness. So this is a lesson for us. Prabhupada mentions that living entities, we should understand just how dangerous this indulgence in unrestricted sex life is. Even to think of sex life is sinful, and in order to compensate such sinful acts or such sinful thoughts, we should give up the conception of enjoying sex life altogether. In the Bhagavad Gita, which is filled with description about how to deal with this lustful propensity, if it comes out in the form of sex life or any other enemy of the living entity, anger, greed, etc. Krishna explains how this all-devouring enemy of the living entity, which is lust, comes into contact with the lower modes and gets transformed into other sub-qualities like wrath, etc., in which allows the living entity in its conditioned state to actually carry out these sinful activities. So, Krishna says, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, Kama Esha Krodha Esha Raja Guna Samudbhava Mahashana Mahapapma Vidhi Ena Ihavayivinam. So, the Supreme Personality of God is speaking to Arjuna. This is in response to Arjuna's question that why the living entities are compelled into sinful acts, even though it is in an unwilling state, as if we are being forced. So Arjuna is inquiring that why are the living entities acting in such a way as if by force? What is the factor that is actually pushing them to behave in this certain unrestricted way or in a degrading way? And Krishna is responding by saying that it is lust only, Arjuna, which is born of contact with the material mode of passion and later transformed into wrath, and which is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. So the contact of the living entity with the lower modes of material nature, not only does it aggravate the propensity to perform lusty activities, but it covers and it keeps the living entity bound in a perpetual cycle of trying to exploit through the modes of material nature, trying to enjoy through passion, trying to enjoy through ignorance, and also trying to enjoy in the mode of goodness, which is contaminating, because that is a material quality. So this lustful propensity, it propels the living entity to behave a certain way, to produce further qualities that will entrap the living entity's subtle body into behaving a certain way. And once that entrapment is there, the living entity deems the activities as normal. So suffering becomes normal. So going through a cycle of anxiety or anger or envy or deceit, whatever these qualities are, it becomes an associated relationship with the conditioned soul. It is normal to be lustful, it is normal to be envious, it is normal to be proud, because the subtle body of the conditioned soul has been associating with this, with these qualities for so long, it becomes like second nature. So as Krishna is explaining this to Arjuna, he explains that there's different types of coverings, there's different degrees of this lust. So Krishna explains in the form of dust covered by a mirror, the embryo in the mother's womb, and fire covered by smoke. So there's different degrees of this lust. Sometimes we see persons are very much deeply engrossed in the mode of ignorance. Some people are deeply engrossed in passion. Some have a tinge towards becoming more sattvic, or they're attracted to a sattva-guna type of lifestyle. So as Krishna also explains later in the Bhagavad Gita, that the modes are perpetually in competition. Sometimes ignorance is more dominant, sometimes passion is dominant, sometimes goodness is dominant. So it goes like that. The modes are always competing, depending on what environment we put ourselves in. So there are different degrees of this lust that covers the living entity. And in this way, the pure consciousness, or the real consciousness of the living entity, becomes obscured. So it requires careful rekindling. It requires careful cleaning in the human form of life, in which we can get rid of this enemy lust by cultivating a Krishna-conscious lifestyle, Krishna-consciousness in every single thing that we do. Now, if we look at the examples out there, sometimes, well, at least for myself, it used to be very difficult to just read but not see the examples. It's at some point, because we're so covered, we're new in Krishna consciousness, everything is new to us. We're learning the terminology, we're learning to see through Shastra. So sometimes we read these sections of the Bhagavatam, and we walk out there and we're going to be able to see what the Bhagavatam is actually talking about. So when we see how this lust is covering people's consciousness, lust is covering people's mind, intelligence, and the senses, the sitting places of lust mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, we see how people act and how they're so controlled by this lustful propensity. Whether it's mainly driven by ignorance or passion, that drive is there to be dominated by that mode. So the living entity keeps on feeding into that mode because that is all the living entity associates with. So I was speaking to one, I was introduced to one girl the other day at Urban Yoga, and she was speaking about her life and what she has gone through and the way in which she was behaving. And I could think of the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where in 13th chapter, where it speaks about people's behavior when they're dominated by a certain mode. And at some point she was telling me how she was averse to being in the sunlight. She wanted to be in darkness. She was happy being in darkness, literally, in a room. She didn't want to know anything. She didn't want to talk to anyone. She just wanted to stay in a dark room. And she became lazy. She became dull-headed. And life was just worthless. There was no drive, no energy, no vitality, because she was steeped in that mode of ignorance. So as she was speaking, I was thinking, wow, this is actually true. We're reminded every day, if you just speak to persons, you can understand just how much the modes of material nature affect people and how serious of a situation it is. However, to see that person transform and speak about how they then remembered they had a Bhagavad Gita and they started reading it, they wake up in the morning to read it, and now they are chanting and they want to take up the lifestyle. So to see the fact that it is possible in this day and age, although very, very degraded, for persons to, by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, to crawl out of these shackles of being controlled by the lower modes of material nature. So it is a possibility. And as Krishna is explaining to Arjuna, that the wise living entity's pure consciousness becomes covered, and his eternal enemy in the form of lust is never satisfied, and it burns like fire. So this is the nature, point blank period. Lust will never be satisfied. Lust pertaining to that which is received, maintained and enjoyed separately from Krishna without knowledge in Krishna, that desire, that propensity will never be satisfied, and it will continuously burn like fire, no matter how much effort you put into it, no matter how much wealth, material wealth, persons gain, they are never satisfied with that material wealth. Right? The founders of so many amazing organizations, or the founders of, you know, Google or Yahoo or different things on the internet, I think the last time I heard it was the CEO for, I can't remember. Okay, I can't remember, I won't use that example. I'll use another example. We have persons who are extremely opulent in this world, especially in the United States of America, which is a place where the most countries around the world model their own countries around the success, the so-called success of the United States of America. So you have extremely wealthy musicians, artists, who are worth billions, millions and billions of dollars. And no matter how big their paycheck is, they still want more. And they work so hard to make an extra 500 million. That some people don't even have 100,000. But you have one woman, one man who is worth 350 billion. And they have so many issues in their lives. And they want to acquire more and more wealth today, and they will kick out anyone in the way who comes or who's an obstacle to their making more and more millions. So although this lusty propensity to create more wealth, more opulence, more fame for themselves, it is still not satisfactory. They still want more. My persons are not satisfied with winning one Grammy or one Oscar or making the Forbes top 5 billionaire list this year. I'm going to make it next year. Therefore, I'm going to work hard and foam in the mouth like an ass, as it's explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I will work hard to get that amount of money in my bank account. I'll work hard to live and play the role of a member in Silicon Valley, the suburb in America where you have to have at least $2 million in your bank account, a Mercedes or a BMW, and each year you try to upscale. So you keep getting more and more, and you keep trying to feed the lusty propensity, but it is unsatisfactory. Very, very unsatisfying. But the insanity of material consciousness is that you keep trying to chew that which has been already chewed. You keep trying to squeeze the nectar from something that has no nectar. It's like I gave, I think the last time we spoke, I gave the example of chewing gum. How in school, at least I did it, we're not allowed to eat in class. So sometimes you're bored out of your mind. I used to be. So you get some sweet, or chewing gum was very, very popular. You chew your gum, you pop it, when the teacher finds out, or you stick it underneath your desk, you forget about it. The next day you think, hey, there's chewing gum. You grab it from underneath, you chew it again. It's a little bit difficult to chew, but nonetheless, there's a little tinge of sweetness. Some sucrose or whatever sugar they've put in, whatever drug they've put in there. So you keep chewing it, then you stick it underneath again. Then tomorrow, take it out again, you chew it, and this time your jaws are aching because it's so hard and stale. There is no taste, but you're committed. Right? Because there's an idea that there might still be something. The fact that I can chew it means there's life. There is some juice, there is some sweetness. So you keep doing that to the point where now it's unchewable. Then you have to get another bubble gum and start the process. So this time it will be a different flavor. You can get strawberry. The next time you'll get peach. The next time you'll get pineapple. So this is the nature of the mature world. You keep trying to chew lust and bite it from all different corners and angles, but it'll never be satisfying. It will never last. There's always a beginning, middle, and an end. There'll be the high moments where you get your sugar rush, and then there'll be the low moments where there's absolutely no pleasure. And the trick of the material energy is to provide variety. So variety, they normally say variety is the spice of life. Material variety is just, it's a hoax, because it also dies. Beginning, middle, and end. So just like, you know, we used to be in the Moomba parade on Swanson Street. So there's so many floats. We're always behind or in front of the Japanese dragon. And then, so there's so many floats passing by. We're just standing there. Wow, this is amazing. And they do the thing. Okay, next float. Yay, this is amazing. Oh, this is really good. It passes. Then the next float comes. Wow, look at those Hare Krishnas. Yay. Then they pass. Then there's another float, and another one, and another one, and another one. All different colors, different tastes, different flavors, different everything. So in the material world, the combinations of, you know, so much illusion is presented to us, and we're thinking, this is really different. It will give me a different taste, a different flavor, a different type of happiness. And then it wears down. And then something else is being presented. Wow, this is really amazing. Now this is going to do it for me. But it is all an illusion. It is all a scam. The material energy will never give satisfying enjoyment. Material senses never get satisfied. Only our spiritual senses, when they come alive in connection to serving the absolute whole, serving our souls, then we really become alive. So we need to reactivate our spiritual senses by the process of Krishna consciousness. So Krishna explains the seniority of the different components of the material body that the living entity is inhabiting. So the senses, the mind and the intelligence are the sin cases of this lust, and through them lust covers the real knowledge of the living entity and bewilders him. So from everything we see, feel, touch, hear with our senses, that is material, this covers the living entity's purity more and more. So Krishna continues, therefore, O Arjuna, the best of the Bharatas, in the very beginning, curb this great symbol of sin, lust, by regulating the senses and slay this destroyer of knowledge and self-realization. So this propensity to enjoy separately from Krishna, this propensity to be attached to an illusory body, an illusory understanding of the self, is very, very difficult to overcome. But by regulating the senses and slaying this destroyer of knowledge and self-realization, by engaging in our constitutional position of being servant of Krishna, we gradually get purified and awaken into our status. So we have to regulate our senses, and we have to bring ourselves into knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So regulation of our senses doesn't mean, what's the English word? What's it called when you... You know, sometimes people say, it doesn't mean repressing the senses. That is artificial. Krishna consciousness is not artificial. It is a natural inclination, it is a natural activity for the soul to engage in that which is Satchidananda, because that is our nature. So relating to the Supreme Lord, relating to the living entities who are parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord, aims at awakening, reawakening that consciousness. So regulation of the senses means we behave in strict moral codes that have been given in Shastras that allow us to focus our mind on hearing and elevating our consciousness. Subject matters dedicated to elevation of consciousness, not subject matters that will dampen the consciousness or that will limit the ability of the consciousness to think, who am I, why am I here, and what is the goal of life. So subject matters that elevate one's consciousness are key to one's getting out of this propensity to perform sinful activity. So by, as Krishna says, the working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses. Intelligence is still higher than the mind, and the soul is even higher than the intelligence. So when we control our mind particularly, we're able to actually be properly free, because then we're not subjugated to any type of action whimsically. When we grab a hold of our mind, we dictate, not that the mind will dictate to the body. So persons sometimes say that the rules and regulations restrict, and we say rules and regulations actually free. They give you freedom, because you are able to filter what comes in, what goes out. You're able to control, with a strong mind, you're able to control what the senses are doing and what the senses will be projecting out. Whereas with an uncontrolled, unrestricted mind, the sense objects will always dictate what you do. So we'll always be dictated upon what we can eat, how we'll eat, we'll be dictated, we'll be pushed by, you know, lustful propensity to enjoy the material nature, whether it's with the opposite sex, whatever it may be. We will be pushed or forced to act. However, if we control the sitting places of where this lusty tendency is, by regulation, by Krishna consciousness, we're actually free. That is real freedom. by accepting and embracing the rules of and regulations of freedom, then we can be, you know, peaceful and happy within this world practicing Krishna consciousness. So regulation of the senses, it is not punishment. With material, if we think with a material mind that regulation means punishment, then everything we do in Bhakti Yoga will be painful, but we have to understand that regulation will actually lead to freedom. Because then we can actually control what comes in and what goes out. When the mind is strong, the senses will become controlled, will be able to become regular. And by reading topics of a higher caliber, higher subject matters pertaining to understanding the soul, the source, and the activities of the living entity, then it will become easy for us to behave in a very, very polished manner. So our intelligence has to seek out our constitutional position, and our intelligence becomes strengthened by reading books like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. So if after hearing all of this, we go out there and we see that the leaders, of course, are in ignorance, and ignorance is the cause of sinful life. Vice versa, sinful life is the cause of ignorance, then we do not really, it is not attractive to an intelligent person to follow such a leader. You know, a few years ago, there was the big drama when a certain president of the world was caught in illicit activities with a 21-year-old girl. You know, the leader of the most powerful nation could not control his senses. And this is a man who can converse with the most, you know, the Vladimir Putins and the, you know, Mubaraks of this world, you name it. This is a person who was very, very well respected and, you know, the leader of the free nation. Yet he was caught red-handed with an intern who was only 21 years old, and he was a married man. Now, we can, and one of the responses people were saying, he's just a man, it's okay. Right? But an intelligent person knows this is not befitting a character of someone who is a leader of a nation. What are young people supposed to think? Oh, our president can do this, surely it must be okay. And the members of the Senate or whatever, as you're saying, you know, he got caught once, big deal. He's just a man, you know, he slipped, it's okay. Right, this was the excuse. It's okay, he just made a mistake. But we understand this is not good character for a leader. To be caught, then denied, and then eventually he had to tell the truth. So it is a very, very embarrassing position when our senses control us. Very, very embarrassing. But if we get a hold of our senses, then, and if we follow what the revealed text give us in terms of how to behave, how to be an ideal teacher and acharya, because people are always looking at us, then we can live life the best possible way by influencing others positively, not negatively. And by doing that, this feature of ignorance will disappear. This fog of ignorance will disappear because we're attracted to the sun. We're attracted to Krishna. And Krishna has given a method, he has given processes how to make sure that fog dissipates gradually, depending on the degree of the intensity of the lust. So in order to rid ourselves of this sinful enemy, this lustful propensity, we attach ourselves to Krishna by practicing the process of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual masters in the association of devotees. And in this way, this fog of ignorance or this darkness is going to be annihilated for good. And I'll stop there and I'll ask if there's any comments or questions.
Swarup, in your preaching at Urban Yoga, like if we apply this understanding that you need to set a good example for people, how much do you observe in your preaching at Urban Yoga that example plays a part in changing people's consciousness?
Okay, so your question is, how does being an example...
How much does that play a part in,
preaching? Oh, okay. Well, it's a big part because people are always asking you. Sometimes they nag you, so what do you do? What do you do at home? Oh, you're married, so how do you live? What do you do for fun? So they'll ask you questions, and people are very, very observant, especially when you come across or when you present yourself as, you know, being a yogi or living a simple lifestyle. Then they ask you questions and they observe your behavior. Sometimes people say, oh, what happened? Oh, you look a bit angry. And sometimes they say, you know, aren't you supposed to be anger-free when you're a spiritual person? So people are always observing our behavior. Are we very rigid or are we very dry and boring? You know, they're always observing. So when you make friends with persons, which is what the beginning phase is, really just making friendships, they will ask you personal questions. Where did you grow up? How did you start becoming a bhakti yoga practitioner? And they'll ask you, what do you do? Because I want to do like you. I was a student too. I was your age too. So how did you do it? So when we converse with them or when we speak to them, they're actually also very, very observant. So it's not so much what we say, but it's also how we interact with the other staff members. So many people always comment, you know, sometimes people have said, you know, I've come here and I've gone, there's one girl who used to come here and she's moved to another state, I won't say where they have something kind of similar. And she said, it was very different there. What I observed was very different, but here it's like this. So it immediately clicked in my head that people are very observant because we're trying to give them a lifestyle. But if what we're preaching is not matching our behavior, are we very kind? Are we compassionate at heart? These are things people feed off when they are even just talking with you. So the way we conduct ourselves is something that's being observed by others. When we're on Harinam or distributing books on the street, some people in buildings are watching. Sometimes a random man has come and said, you know, I've been watching you, when I used to distribute books like 5 years ago or something. Oh, I've been watching you, you know, you're doing very good work. And I saw that man, he was getting on your case, but you're very calm and peaceful. Keep doing it. Just randomly. Right? Or the council man just comes and says, good work, goes off. Or someone starts a whole drama, or someone tries to steal your trolley. There's people watching all the time, so they're seeing how we're behaving and they're thinking, you know, you guys are good people. You're very gentle people. So people are very observant, and they will see that in your behavior with others as well. So it's very important how we behave. Yeah, whenever we make a mistake or if we fall down in anything, any way or whatsoever, we have to accept that that has happened. And we have to, of course, be remorseful about it. It's not that, oh, Krishna says, my devotee shall never perish, therefore I can, or even if one performs an abominable act, he should still be considered saintly because he's on the path. Yes, that is there, but also in our consciousness, in our hearts, we should understand, oh, I did something wrong, or I should have done like this and that. We can approach, if it's with another devotee, express our remorse or our regret about it. We can approach the deities and, you know, offer a prayer to Krishna, whatever it might be, and just pick ourselves up and continue with devotional service, trying not to repeat the same mistake. So we have to recognize, oh, I have this anatta or that anatta. We have to be educated about what might happen while we're on the path. Sometimes we might steer off a little bit, or we might show this quality that's not so good, but we always have to bring ourselves back on the right path. And you do that, of course, by always, you know, revealing our hearts, our mind, and confidence to our authorities, our shiksha or our diksha guru. So there's so many authorities around us, so many people taking care of us, so whenever we need guidance, we approach them so that we understand how to behave, how not to behave. We study shastra to understand the behavior of even though we're just sadhakas, we have to understand how we should behave. And of course, those are checks and balance, gurus, sadhu, and shastra. So we have to be knowledgeable about that and always take guidance. Oh, yes.
If a person is having a physical or mental health problems, that person really wants to do the service to Krishna, but health is restricting that person to do the devotional service in whatever way they can. So what practical solution do you suggest for people who have health problems?
Okay.
Physical or mental, or both?
If people have physical health, mental health problems, they want to do devotional service, what can they do? For whatever reason, of course, whenever we're engaged in service, we are being engaged by another devotee. So we speak with that devotee and they might give us some practical solutions what we can do. But if you look at the scope of devotional service, Prahlad Maharaj explained it from Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Parasevanam, Ashnam, Vananam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Admanivedanam. There are 9 processes there. Even just going out to chant or reading or hearing, that is service. If we're incapacitated, if we cannot be physical or if we're not mentally well, honoring prasadam is a great service. Just giving devotees some chanamrita, or there are so many light things that we can do. We can read about Krishna, we can chant Krishna's name, we can distribute a little prasadam here, there. We can do small things, that is also devotional service. So if we're physically or mentally challenged, there are small things that we can do. Like there's a broad spectrum. Devotional service is so broad, it's not just limited to one or two things. So if that devotee is in a difficult situation, they can approach whoever's been engaging them or anyone who is responsible for giving service and explain their situation. And that devotee will be intelligent enough to say you can do X, Y, Z or A, B, C according to our health status. So there's always something that we can do. Okay, all right, thank you very much. Bhantavachana Bhagavatam Ki Jai Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai.